Don't you know that you still have your powers? All your powers. And you always will. You're Brian Kenny, for fuck's sake.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Full Circle.
This is our season finale.
Ooh.
And it first aired in the U.S. on June 24th, 2001 and worldwide on June 25th, 2001.
It was directed by Alex Chappell, who directed episode 15, The Ties That Bind. He eventually directed 8 Queer as Folk episodes, and this is his second. We talked about him a little bit in episode 15, but to recap, he went on to direct tons of television. And here are some of my favorites. 24 episodes of Law & Order, SVU. 3 episodes of Elementary, starring Johnny Lee Miller. Blue Bloods, Chicago Fire, The Americans, Law & Order LA, plain old Law & Order. Law & Order Criminal Intent, Stargate Universe, which is my favorite in the Stargate franchise. When I was writing this up, I noticed an interesting piece of Alex Chappell trivia. He directed 2 characters from Trainspotting in different TV shows. In Stargate Universe, Robert Carlyle had the role of Dr. Rush. In Trainspotting, he played Begbie. I didn't realize that until much later after watching both of those. Johnny Lee Miller played Sick Boy in Trainspotting, and he plays Sherlock Holmes in Elementary.
Here's the Showtime synopsis for the season finale. Michael and David prepare for their move to Portland as Brian turns 30. While Ted finally faces the truth about Blake, and Justin attends his prom with Daphne, where the couple is in for a big surprise.
Attends his prom. That was a Showtime synopsis?
Showtime.
Let me look at the IMDb synopsis here. Brian turns 30. Michael and David prepare for their move to Portland. Ted faces the truth about Blake. Justin and Daphne attend their prom, where a big surprise awaits. On his way to the airport, Michael receives a call from Brian. That's pretty close.
That is. To me, that says that IMDb ripped off Showtime.
No surprise there.
Nope, none at all.
This episode I approached with a certain sense of reticence, knowing that it's the last one that we're going to be talking about this season. The theme here tracked with that, which is one of separation. Dr. David and Michael are going to end up being separated by the end of this episode. Brian and Justin are more or less going to be separated by the end of this episode. Ted and Blake are separated by the end of this episode. So everyone has a kind of a loss of one sort or another going on in this episode. So that seemed to be the entire A story going through it.
And well, this episode opened with...
Ooh, this was a hot opening.
let's say a montage. Let's call it
a montage of fuck.
I called it a sex binge.
I like montage of fuck.
Montage of fuck, sex binge. I feel like they're both very strong choices here. Brian is basically fucking anything that moves. Mm-hmm. All the while this is happening against, you know, the blue light that he has. Mm-hmm. We're seeing the phone conversations of everybody else in these little like boxes appear on top of it. And it reminded me a lot of Telephone Hour from the Bye Bye Birdie movie. And
I like that scene. I like the entire way that this was playing out.
And after it looks like Brian is spent, everyone has arrived at Brian's apartment as he lays there naked and exposed in his bed, all to just taunt and tease him because it is his birthday and he is finally 30. And I called this Ted's revenge.
I like the buildup to it where they're having this conversation with a telephone and we're not entirely sure what they're talking about until they show up at his loft. So I like the pacing. What I thought was a little strange was that they are jumping into bed and unrolling him while he's naked. I mean, it was just a little unusual.
At first, when it was showing everyone above him with a sort of like fishbowl, fish eye
fishbowl
look of the lens of the camera, I thought he was like having a nightmare or was this, or something like that. But no, they were just there and he was just groggy and hungover or something from all of the sex. But yeah, it was very weird for them to all show up, untangle him in his
in his
sheets as he's fully naked. And I'm just like, what is going on?
Yeah, it was a confusing little opening, but it was fast paced and there was a lot going on. And I think at one point they had six characters playing telephone over the top of that scene. And then they blindfold him and they take him to a funeral home complete with a cake tombstone that's there. So I was left wondering what kind of a funeral home would allow that sort of tomfoolery.
Probably one on Liberty Avenue.
Liberty Death.
Yeah.
There was nice costuming going on. They were all wearing black.
You can always trust gay people to stick to a theme.
Michael had on a little bit of off black, which I thought was interesting. I think he had some gray in his costuming. But I did like that they put that thought into it and they coordinated their dress for this event. At this point, we also find out that Brian is not going to New York. So he climbs into the coffin and closes the lid.
And of course, with this new information, now Michael is filled with major regret because he has agreed to move to Portland with Dr. David Cameron. And he did so on the assumption that Brian was moving away to New York and he didn't need to really stick around Pittsburgh. And I feel like it's very clear because as soon as Brian drops that news, you see Michael's heart just sink.
I thought it was a loose connection, though, between the two. I didn't pick it up at first and the second time through that I was watching the episode. The first time I watch it, I take notes and then I watch it again too. I just try to enjoy it and watch the pacing of it. And it wasn't until the second time that I started to get a hint of that. So I thought that thread was a little dangly and I didn't quite get it until Dr. David brought it up in the next scene. He's entirely taking control of Michael and the move.
Is there anything I can do?
Yeah, you can.
One more. Throw this on.
Stand there and look gorgeous. But you do so beautifully.
Isn't it great to be in love with a guy who does everything?
Yeah. So I guess I'll just go to the beauty parlor and get my nails done.
I thought he was just being a dick about it.
First, we need to talk about Michael being in carpenter jeans. I took a look.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yeah. There was one moment where the camera was behind Michael and he like bent down and I saw the pockets and I was just like, oh. No, Michael. Bad. But here's where I'm in total agreement with you about Dr. David Cameron, because there's a moment where he says, isn't it great to be in love with a guy who does everything?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's not cute.
No,
Dr. David Cameron. And that's where I'm like, I would have thought we would have learned from this, Dr. David Cameron. I understand that things need to move quickly because you are in a time crunch to get over to help Hank and be there with your son.
Yeah, he totally was very much in project manager mode.
But it's now like him bulldozing the situation to a point where I was very much in Michael's corner and understand his frustration.
Yeah, Dr. David had literally packed up all of Michael's things, which that really drove the point home for me, which is, okay, it's fine if you're packing up the sofa and the LP collection, but hands off my clothes type of thing.
Absolutely.
So it drove the point home. In other news, at the law offices of Kurtzman, Vasquez, Shiro, and Marcus, we find that Melanie is in the lobby waiting for a call from Bender at the ACLU. I just thought that somebody had punched up that script in a really bad way there. I didn't quite understand why.
Why was she waiting for this call? I must have literally missed this because
it just seems strange that it was just kind of pushed in there. So I didn't quite like that. Ted discovers that Blake isn't at the office though.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that he mentioned this morning he wasn't feeling well. I think he's got the flu or something, and he didn't want to share his germs with anyone.
Well, that's thoughtful, but frankly, Teddy, this isn't the first time, and when he is here, he's slow and he doesn't complete tasks we assign him. The other partners are pissed. They want him gone.
Melanie, line one.
I'll talk to him. I don't know.
Oh, that's my call. Excuse me, guys.
I did like the writing here where Ted had to lie on Blake's behalf. that was the moment we see Ted kind of crossing the line where he becomes complicit in Blake's addiction, and he's part of it at that point. He's going to try to fix him, and he's going to lie to his friends in order to accomplish it. So that was some clever writing there.
Yes, and I was like waiting on the moment for Mel to catch him in that lie and say like, oh no, this is what Blake told us. Mm-hmm. So I was waiting on that moment, but I guess it didn't happen. It was just simple that he just didn't show up. I'm surprised there also wouldn't have been like a friend moment between Mel and Ted going like, hey, I stuck my neck out for him and he's doing all this shitty stuff. What's going on kind of thing.
Right.
But that's not happening. So instead this is where it's revealed that he's like very slow in the work, or he can't complete tasks, and they want him gone now. And granted, I mean, he was given the job on a temporary basis to see how he does. But I guess this should be expected from someone who literally has no background in paralegal work.
This episode was written by Ron Cohen and Daniel Lippman. So I feel like the writing was a lot tighter in this episode than the last one, which if you listen to that episode, I kind of lost my shit on how poorly written it was.
And we should be careful about bringing it up again, because I don't want to
get I'll get wound up again. You just look out. I will turn this car around. Emmett had some great lines here. He was throwing a little bit of shade to Ted.
Except it's not his germs he didn't want to share. It's his drugs.
Thank you for not saying anything. Why do you always have to be so fucking cynical?
I'm not cynical. But you know what? I'd rather be fucking cynical than in fucking denial.
Oh, he went beyond shade and he went straight savage, and it was great.
I loved it. Set Ted straight once and for all. This guy tried to kill him, remember?
And I think
we forgot about that.
And I 100% agree with you that by Ted going along and trying to ignore the problem, or trying to not acknowledge the issue, is definitely making him complicit and is in no way being any more helpful to Blake as it was with Emmett in the previous episode, still being snippy about their relationship when we knew Blake was possibly not using.
In my head, I knew that he had never stopped using. So I like the way that these storylines were carrying through, where it's the is he or isn't he moment, because I knew he was in the back of my head. And I like the way that this creeped back in a really subtle way. Meanwhile, at Debbie's house, there's a PFLAG meeting, and Jennifer Taylor makes an appearance.
I was so happy to see her again.
Yet it's too bad that she had like very little to do in this episode. We miss Sherry Miller, and I'm looking forward to next season where she plays a role front and center in the series.
I do like that they are at least finding moments where it shows that she and Debbie are in a way now raising Justin together. Like even that moment when he comes home and makes a comment about like, oh, hi, mom. And they both say something. I thought that was a really cute and clever thing. And they even laugh about it and find it fun. And they can see that they're both shepherding Justin into this new phase of his life.
Hey, mom.
Hi.
Jennifer's evolving here. She started out way back at the beginning of the series as always referring to this Brian. Now she's a kind of a more fully formed suburban mother of a gay teenager.
Yeah, it's like she, Debbie, and Vic are like Three's Company. I really like it.
There is some bad prop work in this particular episode. This is the PFLAG meeting, and they're stuffing envelopes with the envelopes didn't have any addresses on them. They're just stuffing empty envelopes and putting stamps on them. So I think the prop department kind of missed that there. The real reason this scene happened was so that everybody could figure out that, or everyone could find out that Justin's not going to the prom.
Yeah, so we are told that Justin doesn't want to go because he doesn't really want to go with a girl, so he doesn't understand why he should go. And I like that this is a great opportunity for Jennifer to step up, and she's saying, like, you should feel like you should go and go with the person you should. And I really love that we're seeing that Jennifer is becoming 100% in his corner and is not trying to excuse anyone else's behavior against him.
Finally.
Finally. And it's great that he finds the courage to want to decide to go, regardless of any preconceived notion of what might happen while he's there.
Yeah, he really had no idea what he was going to be in for. He kind of had a little bit of naivete about what prom might be like, did you ever go to prom?
I did.
You probably went with a girl though.
Oh yeah, I definitely went with a girl because I wasn't out in high school. But I went with a friend and there was nothing else there. I had fun because I knew I was going to go and I spent a lot of time with my friends. That's why it was okay with me. And I'm kind of in that camp of, I felt like it was a rite of passage, but I think things have definitely changed today.
Do they even still have a prom?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. But we see now that, now, granted, this could also be in just an effort for certain schools to show how progressive they are. And I don't know how much they truly believe in this. But we are seeing a lot of prom king and queens are being awarded to people who are queer, non-gender conforming, or trans, or who follow outside the tradition. And I think that's really exciting. Granted, at my prom, we didn't do prom king or queen. I think we did like homecoming king and queen, but no one really gave a shit about that. So it's really cool that I think today we're starting to see a push in a progressive sense compared to what happens at this prom.
I didn't go to any of my proms, but I did go to the Valentine's Day dance that was called Here's My Heart. I went with a boy named Jake. I won't say his last name. I don't think that Jake fully understood that I was gay and into him. So this dance was kind of set up as, let's go as friends.
But really?
Yeah, I had other things in mind and he clearly didn't. Nothing weird happened or anything like that, but it raised a little bit of eyebrows because the way that this dance was set up, it was kind of a more formal type of thing where there's assigned seating. And so it was basically boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, according to like who you're bringing. So it's boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, boy. We didn't dance or anything. And I know. I used to have such wild fantasies about Jake and what it would be like at Here's My Heart. I was prepared to give him my heart. Never happened. I still creeped on him on Facebook every once in a while.
What's...
Nothing to look at anymore.
Aw. Yeah. Is he gay? Is he straight?
Nope. He's Well, he's apparently straight, so.
Jake, what could have been?
Yes.
Jake, if you ever listen to this, feel free to keep in touch.
I think for a while I was even calling him Jakey to his face. It was like my first awkward attempt at. It's kind of like when you're in third grade or something and you like some girl and you let her know by punching her.
No, I think your story is a lot sweeter. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe and rate us on iTunes. We like those 5 stars.
Let's talk about an even sweeter story of Ted and Blake. Oh. Bad boy Blake comes home to Ted's condo. He's breathless after a long day of being a paralegal, apparently.
And working on a really special case.
And he's ready to fuck.
I mean, he comes in and takes off his clothes. He is downing water like nobody's business. And he wants Ted to just fuck the shit out of him.
I thought that Dean Armstrong, he plays Blake Wiezecki, is really good at playing a meth head. I thought that he can really deliver all the characteristics of a cranked out method.
It was already sort of scary when you see him in the in Babylon tweaked out, but like seeing him in Ted's home tweaked out was disturbing in a way.
Yeah, it had this really like moment to it because he just bursts in the door. He starts ripping his clothes off. There's no underwear check here.
No.
There's maybe a 2-second shot where his ass fills half the screen as he climbs aboard Ted. Did you see that one?
Absolutely. And he immediately starts taking off Ted's clothes.
Yeah, and there's a really unfortunate underwear check on Ted because Ted's just wearing the most nasty boxer shorts that I've ever seen. And Blake just pulls him right off and starts blowing him. And Ted's like, I know he's on meth and I know all this is going on, but blow away, Blake.
But no, the evolution of him then allowing Blake to continue blowing him.
It didn't take much.
Well, there was first Blake all over him, kissing him wise, and he shoves him off. Blake basically demanding that I want this. And so then he goes and starts removing his pants. And it's almost like a state of shock for Ted. And then what's so clearly or very subtly placed is as Blake is going down on him, Ted is not touching him until we see him reach his hand down and push down on Blake's head. And that's where it's that moment of like, I know what's going on, but I'm gonna keep going anyway. And that's a dark turn, I think, for Ted too.
Yeah, this scene had all the elements of creepiness to it where we really see that Blake is bad fucking news. Well, let's talk about the diner the next day. So Ted appears looking like he just rode a horse for the Pony Express. He's kind of walking like wide-legged. As he comes into the diner, it was just a little forced, but I was like, hey, I get that.
Oh, you do, Patrick.
Oh, yeah. He literally fucked Blake all night and got 30 minutes of sleep. So if we do the math and say, well, he's an accountant, so he's probably going for seven and a half hours of sleep a night. He fucked that guy for 7 hours. Let's just leave that one.
I'm very curious about Ted now and his stamina to go for 7 hours.
He's an animal.
Yeah, good Ted.
Emmett again gives up the sage advice of going home and changing the locks so that Blake can't come back and get into the apartment. I'm still unclear, though, of why Ted is so attracted to this guy. Everybody can see that Blake is a total loser and he's trouble and he's dangerous. What is Ted's real attraction to that danger?
I don't think it's the danger. I think we were set up from the very beginning that Ted does not have a lot of luck in the love department, right?
Yeah.
So here we have someone who, from the get-go, pursued him. Is that something that
nearly
he
to
can
his
get?
Death.
Right. Is that really something he feels he can give up? Because in a way, Blake is sort of Ted's addiction from having the love and the life that he probably wants, but it's not the proper way to go about it because it's not good for Blake either.
I can see a little of that symbiosis, as it was called in an earlier episode, between Ted and Brian. And I think that's a kind of the Sid and Nancy effect where the addicts can kind of play on each other. They have slightly different addictions, but they just feed into each other. So that might be one explanation for it, but Ted is just going so whole hog, blind, and becoming complicit.
And this is that moment where I think Emmett finally gives him that ultimatum because he can see how hard this is being on Ted. And so they finally decide that they need to get him to go to rehab. They need him to get
professional
help he needs rather than someone taking him in, because Ted can only do so much. And it's clear that it's not good for Ted, and that in turn is not good for Blake.
There was a little bit of a disturbing scene going on at the St. James Academy this morning. Chris Hobbs comes up behind Justin in the hallway and just knocks him to the ground and calls him a fag.
Fag. Fuck you, Hobbs.
You okay? What an asshole.
Thank God I won't have to see him again for the rest of my life.
I was left thinking, how does assaulting students get ignored by that school to that degree?
I mean, we know that there's faculty that is definitely not in Justin's corner. So Hobbs has the hubris that he can get away with it because he knows that even if Justin were to try to go to someone about it, nothing would get done.
But it seems like a kind of a cut and dry thing where if you lay hands on somebody, that's crossed the line. That's like police. That's not like principal or headmaster.
Zero tolerance feels like, at least in a private school like this, probably leans one way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of, here's a gay student that's not really tolerated. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that where they would be gaslighting Justin. It's like, well, if you wouldn't flaunt yourself, you wouldn't be in the situation. Justin tries to use words to fight back because I think he tells him to fuck off or fuck you. And
yeah. Fuck you, Hobbs.
Yeah. That's what he gets at, because
this is the guy that like almost started a fire. Well, he did start a fire in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And so in St. James Academy, it's a very wild, wild west type of thing here. You can burn down the place and you can punch students and knock them over and all without like any kind of legal problems. Mm-hmm. This is a dangerous school.
But at least this interaction allows Daphne to enter the picture again.
Oh, yeah. We haven't seen Daphne since she got fucked, right?
Yes. And things got weird after they said, let's make
fucked
sure.
Fucked by Justin.
Let's make sure things don't get weird. They got weird. Are we surprised? Not at all.
Ta-da.
And Daphne is there to help him, and they go and they have a heart-to-heart about prom.
They were smoking. Like, they just step out the door of the school and they light up right on the porch.
As you said, this is the Wild Wild West, and I think because it's a private school, kids do more.
There are
against
things,
the strict rules.
There are things about that school that reminds me of my private school upbringing, but the amount of discipline that goes on in this school doesn't hold a candle to like what I went through.
I went to public school, so I know nothing.
Yeah, if you were smoking on the porch with the girl that you had fucked and you were gay, you were in trouble. So Justin invites Daphne to the prom as friends. All of a sudden, the weirdness is over, I guess.
Yeah, and all they had to say was, weirdness over? Over.
Done. Click.
It's just that easy, folks. It's like, set it and forget it.
I'll give him a pass on this one, and not just because in the last episode I was so critical of sloppy writing. I think that teenagers really can get over something like that just by saying it. All you have to do is come out and say, yeah, it was weird. Yeah, it's not going to be weird anymore. Okay, done. I think it kind of works. So I didn't have a big problem with that line.
A big point to bring up is the only reason why Justin invited Daphne to the prom is because the night before at Babylon, Justin had attempted to ask after being definitely encouraged by Three's company to ask Brian. Ask the person he really actually cares about. And I love that he made a point where he said, like, you're 30. It's not like you're 40. And this is what I want to ask you, Patrick. What did you think of that phrase?
I don't know. It's like, we get it. Stop force feeding us the notion that Brian is 12 years older than Justin. We get it. We know that. We've already processed it. We've gone through 21 hours of this show. So enough already. It's...
Age is not that big an issue.
Well, it is a big issue, but we already know these things. Right. We don't need to continually be hit over the head with them. That's why in this entire season, I didn't like how there was so much discontinuity between the writers. It's almost as if they got an order for 22 shows. Ron Cohen and Daniel Lippman farmed it out to all the writers that they knew and their friends and said, here, write this episode. Almost in a vacuum without knowing what the other writers were working on other than these broad themes. Season two, I'm more optimistic about because the stories were mostly written by Cohen and Lippman. So I think this fixes itself the deeper we get into the show. Let's go shopping with Brian, Lindsay, and Gus. Lindsay, this is some sloppy writing, I thought. Lindsay quotes from Brian's copy from a commercial.
It's the beginning. A whole new way of thinking about yourself. Feeling a whole new sense of entitlement. An accomplishment.
That's from the La Jeunesse anti-aging commercial.
I wrote that fucking copy.
I just hate some of these overly crowbarred lines. I don't know. I just thought that was a little bit of a throwaway. They could have written that a little bit more eloquently versus Lindsay quoting a commercial and Brian saying, hey, I wrote that commercial. Yes,
I think that was, well, it's Lindsay just using
Brian's words against him.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily against him, but at least it's saying, you know, is this something that you believe? Like, here's something you said.
Yeah, but he works in advertising. Of course, he doesn't believe what he's doing. I mean, he's a professional copywriter in that sense. So he's writing for his client. Lindsay's trying to use those words against him somehow.
But I think the big point of this scene is that Brian bought a scarf.
Yeah, nice silk scarf with tassels on it.
Very very John Voight scarf is what I thought.
What could he have in mind for that scarf, I wonder?
Well, now we have to check in on the Dr. David's dismantled architecturally perfect mid-century.
They're taking it apart.
It is literally coming apart at the seams. Everything has been packed away in storage and or is ready for Portland.
They're just about in sleeping bags on the parquet floors.
It's time for them to get ready to go to a goodbye party.
Did we know at this point that it was a goodbye party? Because I just remember the intro line is Michael running around saying, where's my flannel?
Exactly. Yes. There was
flannel.
There was no indication that this was actually a goodbye party that Emmett was hosting for Michael and Dr. David Cameron. Instead, yeah, there was just some sort of flannel party that Emmett's hosting, which I'm like, that sounds flannel? On par for him.
Michael talks about his future with David. Dr. David just interrupts him. I thought that was really telling here. This was some writing that I liked because it was subtle. We didn't get clobbered by it. Michael's just talking about what his life is going to be like in Portland, and David's not hearing it. He's thinking about the tactical and not the strategic. He's figuring out like how to hang the screen door and things like that. He won't let Michael do anything. This is a little bit of new behavior from Dr. David. In the past, we had seen that he was a little more dominant and a little more in control, I guess, because he's older, wiser, has some of the answers that Michael may not have. But here, they really turned up the volume on Dr. David taking control of Michael's entire life, almost as if Michael became his marionette.
I agree that it's like they took the issues that were present in the beginning of the relationship with Dr. David Cameron's control issues, and they just turned it to 11. And I think Michael makes a good point about him like going to getting his nails done or something like that about just like, I guess that's all I'm supposed to do. Cause yeah, he brings up a valid point about like, when we get there, what am I supposed to do? And I think Dr. David Cameron says like, well, if we need to talk about it, let's talk about it. But it feels like you want to give Michael the floor, but you're doing it just to get him off your back.
Right.
You know, I'm going to like, yes. Oh yes, dear. Let's talk about it. This is where they decided to really make Dr. David Cameron a character that even turned me off. And you know me, I have been in the Dr. David Cameron corner the entire season.
You're ready to go find your own chiropractor.
And I'm just like, we are now seeing him in a light that takes past behavior and really amped it up so that we can start to dislike him.
Ostensibly, he's doing it for Hank, his son, J.T. York,
right.
Degrassi.
Before he was stabbed.
Right. Ostensibly, that's why he's doing it, but I don't think he needed to here. This was a little confusing about why they needed to create these obstacles for Michael.
Right, because the obstacle has already been created with Brian not leaving Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And that's enough conflict for me. That now we have Michael possibly regretting the choice to move away because what he thought was changing is not changing anymore.
I did like the way the story played out eventually. It just seemed like it didn't need to play out that way. I don't think that we needed to see Dr. David as an antagonist. I think he could have carried out his entire role in Michael's life and this entire drama of Michael eventually not going to Portland without having to become an ogre about it.
Yes. So
interesting story choices there.
Be sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We'll be right back. But we get to Emmett's apartment for this flannel party that's actually Michael's goodbye party. When gays have a theme, they commit, as we saw with Brian's death day party. We see a full-on... Everyone is in flannel. Emmett is spraying like some sort of pine scent.
Yeah, I thought that this theme was ridiculous, but then I wrote that down when I was reviewing the episode. But I think about it now, and I'm like, you think it sounds kind of fun? It's not necessarily supposed to be representative of Portland. It's intended to be an exaggeration, the way that gay guys love to go all out in costume. And so I started to kind of like the party, especially that moose that was
in
the middle
of this party.
How did they get that moose up there?
Again, Emmett had a theme. He committed to it and yeah. He makes things happen. It was great.
Somebody called out flannel as lesbian lingerie, which I thought was funny.
Well, and what's really funny is I think Mel and Lindsay were in the exact same flannel.
Oh, yeah.
The red and black.
I think they have Gus in the same flannel.
And Gus
too.
Is the same one. But what's really crazy is that everyone seems to start to say goodbye.
It's a goodbye party, right?
It's a goodbye. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a goodbye party, but like you would think the show itself was ending the way this was wrapping
up. Oh, yeah. I did like how Emmett was basically falling apart every time he's talking to Michael.
Well, honey, you ever want to come home? You just cook your heels three times.
He's just so out there and he's open and honest about it. And he just bursts into tears. And then the scene transitions to Michael and Ted. Michael says to Ted,
"Guess I'll miss you most of all, Scarecrow."
Why is Ted the Scarecrow? The Scarecrow wanted a brain. What did that mean?
I think he was just making a joke, Patrick.
Well, you picked the wrong character for Ted, right?
I mean, Ted is acting pretty brainless with Ted, so maybe it was accurate.
If anything, Ted needs courage, not a brain or a heart. Yeah. So I think they missed an opportunity because Ted needs the courage to get rid of Blake.
Well, Dorothy does say that she'll miss the Scarecrow most of all. So that really, he's just quoting the movie.
I think I'll miss you most of all.
In the movie, Scarecrow, the actor, is also credited as Scarecrow/Hunk. So.
Okay. But also at this party.
This is a fun party. Let's have one.
Because the drama.
Why aren't we having a rap party after this episode with a moose and flannel and scarecrows?
But at this party is also all of the drama. Everyone decides to get their dirty laundry out.
Yeah, bring your flannel and your drama to the party.
Because this is the moment where Ted believes it to be okay to have his intervention with Blake. And I'm like,
let's do it in front of the moose.
Read the room. Maybe this is not the time to do this.
At first, I thought that this was going to be like a short comedy moment where Ted says,
"All right, look, let's not pretend there isn't a moose in the middle of the room, okay?"
Because they're standing like right at the moose's ass. I just love that storyline.
But even with like the comedy trying to break the tension, he puts it to Blake that in order to see if their relationship can survive, he needs to get professional help because he found the drugs. And he said, "I wasn't looking for it. And honestly, I don't care how you got it, but this is the true story. You need help. Otherwise, we cannot be together."
This was shot very well because it had a slight up angle on Ted where we started to see Ted taking a little more of an authoritarian view on the youth, Blake. So I liked the way that it was shot. And I liked the way that the director pulled tension into it between them. You know, that's absolutely the wrong place to be having that conversation. You almost wanted them to keep their voices down. I like the built-in tension.
So we have Ted and Blake having their confrontation.
Well, let's find another one going on.
So then we have Dr. David Cameron and Michael deciding to have it out at the party because Michael is upset. And what it finally like breaks the camel's back is Dr. David Cameron made a change in the reservation for the flights.
Yeah, I'm on Michael's side with this one. It's like you can't just if you're moving to Portland, you can't just change your flight from early morning to late evening without telling your partner who's also going to be on the flight.
Right. I mean, there is so much assumption made.
That's a foul on Dr. David's part.
I feel like at this point, this is a moment where I'm flabbergasted by Dr. David Cameron's behavior.
Do you think it's real or do you think it's just bad writing? Do you think it's on purpose?
I think the writing amped up the drama to
11
to accelerate the decisions made by the characters rather than find an organic growth to it.
I'm wondering if this got turned up to make the stakes a little bit higher for Michael to be able to turn around and leave a lot behind versus getting on the plane with Dr. David. I think in my head, it might've been enough without all this pent up drama going on. But it seems like this was all kind of leading that direction where we had to have more for Michael to walk away from when he ran back from the plane. In the end, it was a no brainer, but this was a pretty big goodbye party. These days, I think it's easy to maintain close relationships with your friends long distance. This episode made it seem like they were going to be gone forever, that they were never going to be heard from again.
And they were never going to see each other again. And it's like, well, Michael's mom still lives in Pittsburgh. So yeah. Back. So yeah, it was a very odd way to try and place the goodbyes. But yeah, I mean, today, I mean, it's so easy to keep in touch now that.
Yeah, I think both of us, you and I, Matt, we have friends like around the globe.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, not like we go out for a drink every night at Woody's, but we keep in touch. We know what they're up to broadly. I don't know. This was like the big goodbye. And we've seen this before in Queer as Folk, and I kind of hate it when these episodes come around, because these days, 17 years later, it seems like less of a big deal. People come and go all the time. Everybody gets replaced. It's like one character pops out of your life. There's always like another understudy that's waiting to step up into that role mm-hmm. or to become, you know, part of the gang. It's just not that big of a deal anymore.
Now, we have one person who is noticeably absent from Michael's goodbye party, and that is Brian. So what is Brian doing?
Whiskey, weed, trail mix, and a scarf. in no particular order. Like I said, it is the order, actually.
While all of this drama is going on at the party, it is intercut with Brian basically having his own party. And he is doing all of the drugs. He is drinking. I mean, he is doing the ultimate treat yourself night.
This scene was really strange, if you ask me.
Well, and then we see him continually throwing this scarf up in the air. And then we see that it finally comes down to him and his pants only slightly pulled down,
mm-hmm.
just enough so we see his ass, and he is yanking it.
Yeah, he's rubbing one out while auto asphyxiating himself.
So he has tied the scarf around his neck. He has taken multiple hits of the trail mix, and so his vision is incredibly blurry. And as I think he's about to hit that amazing orgasm, Michael appears and pulls him down from the chair that he's on mm-hmm. because I'm sure, you know, at first glance, even though it's very clear that he is jerking off furiously, by the way, Michael thinks he's trying to kill himself or something. So he yanks him down and he asks Brian what he's doing.
Well, I think Michael knew what was going on, but did we? It's like, what?
Oh, I thought I put it together.
But why is he doing this? The reason that Cohen and Lippman give us is that this is to get the best fucking orgasm of his life for his 30th birthday. This is a lot of effort to go to.
Well, that's also that. I think on the surface, that's what he's saying.
You think he's trying to kill himself?
I don't think he was trying to kill himself.
What was he trying to do?
I can't tell you what the deeper meaning was to it, but I don't buy that it was just so he could have a great orgasm.
What else is there? What?
Well, I would like to think that there's more to Brian than just having great orgasms. As a character, I would like to think there's more going on. I can't necessarily.
Yeah, I just thought this whole thing was weird. It was, I think, out of character for Brian. Granted, he turned 30. We know that he's always been addicted to youth. But what's he doing? It's almost like in the writer's room, they had a bulletin board where they had an index card that said character attempts auto asphyxia. And they were just pulling cards off to try to assign these various gay things to characters. Auto asphyxia is probably like one of the stupidest things that people can attempt just to get off.
Well, and Michael says that.
Yeah.
So
in this one isolated instance, Michael and I are thinking the same way.
Having a little celebration of my own in honor of my big 3-0.
With this?
Yeah.
I give myself a very special gift.
Like what?
Like the greatest fucking orgasm of my life. Try the last fucking orgasm of your life. You could kill yourself.
Well, that wouldn't be the worst thing that could happen.
I also thought that Michael's dialogue after Brian more or less like comes to, after he gets lowered down from these rafters that we never knew were in the loft for a scarf that's only maybe like 2 feet long, 3 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
The logistics of it. I see you looking up at
I wanted to see what your loft had. but yeah, I don't think you can really tie a scarf up here.
Well, certainly not one that's like 3 feet long. No. So after Michael gets him down, he starts yelling at Brian about being always young and beautiful and never losing his superpowers.
Don't you know that you still have your powers? All your powers. And you always will. Whether you're 18 or you're 30 or you're 50 or you're 100, you will always be young and you will always be beautiful. You're Brian Kenny, for fuck's sake!
This scene was dumb. And I'm getting wound up again after.
Why do you think it's dumb? I mean, what Brian was attempting was dumb.
It was. And Michael's like logic for why Brian should stick around was the dumb part.
I think what Michael is trying to express to Brian is that Brian has a persona that will always help him get laid, always be successful. Like, he has the charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
No, he doesn't.
Always do that. So no matter if he is 30, 40, 50, he will have that to carry him through. And that's the superpower that Michael is talking about. That's something that nobody else in the group has. It's
except for Captain Astro.
Sure. So it is Brian being Brian that will always give him success.
So you're saying that the dialogue here was like a lot deeper than
I'd like to think
my initial superhero read of it?
Yes.
Like comic book read of it?
Yeah. Well, I think he's using the comic book analogy to bring the point across.
We'll be right back. In the meantime, click subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Still Queer as Folk.
So the next day, Ted tried to make Blake go to rehab.
No, no, no.
This is, again, I mean, at least we see that this is Ted's fixing Blake traits are coming back, but this is at least a better direction than it should have been, or that it has been in the past.
He's finally getting professional help. Am I the only one that realizes that a drug addict needs professional help, that you can't do it yourself? It's not a DIY project.
No, I think television drama has not caught on. They treat it as though this is the final test of, or the true test of their relationship, that if Blake really truly loves Ted, that he can beat the drugs and show that he loves Ted more than the drugs.
There was this little sub theme. Ted leaves Blake with a CD of La Traviata, which is their theme opera. And Blake admits it's the only opera that he knows. This I saw as a subtle little reminder that Ted is trying to invent somebody for himself by fixing Blake, that he's willing to accept all the imperfections of this guy that he kind of barely knows, that put him into a coma, that is continually betraying him. I like that there is this little cue there with La Traviata. Later that night, Ted and Emmett show up at the rehab clinic with flowers, only to find that Blake checked out.
It's literally, it was literally, I think, what, that morning he checked in, and by that afternoon he had checked out?
Yeah. He was just gone.
And, I mean, the guy at the rehab says that, you know, it's voluntary, you know, we can't hold people.
Right. Like, I did like that Blake had left La Traviata for Ted, and I started to wonder, I wrote in my notes here, what did that mean? Was he saying to Ted, goodbye, farewell, and amen? Or was he saying, I'd like you to have this back? I think it was, this is over. You can't help me. This isn't our song anymore because I can't play the ending of it. And in fact, we don't see Blake for a very long time after this, right?
I think it could be that Ted or Blake knows that he has to try and fix this on his terms. And that means not dragging along Ted, because we don't see Blake for a very long time.
I almost wish that they would have had kind of a knockdown, drag out attic fight in order to wrap up this Blake Ted arc.
Yeah.
Instead, it's a very subtle one, which I can respect and I appreciate. I just hope for a tiny bit more.
So we see one relationship fall apart. Let's see how another relationship is handling
Dr. itself. Dr. David's dismantled, architecturally perfect mid-century modern home. The debate between Dr. David and Michael about Michael not going to Portland is still going on. This wasn't really resolved after their little exchange at the party, the flannel party. Dr. David thinks it's about Brian staying in Pittsburgh. Okay, fair comment. At this point, though, it looks like Michael isn't going, even though his entire life is on a moving van headed across the country.
Thank you for bringing this up, because this is just like a logistical thing that I had to know.
What do you mean you're not going? Go get your stuff.
Things are already on their way there.
Yeah, like, you're in.
You are in it to win it. So. Right. However, I feel like Dr. David Cameron knows that Michael doesn't want to go now, and he gives him the out. I don't think that he's excited about it, but because like, I think what leaves us is Dr. David Cameron leaves him a ticket and says it's open-ended.
Yeah, I don't think that ticket's open-ended. That's the same ticket that they bought together. There's some holes here in the story, but I could see where Cohen and Lippman were going. I didn't have a huge problem with it. I did like that Dr. David had this notion that it was about Brian. That brings back a lot of past stories where it really was obvious that it was about Brian. And Michael comes out and he's saying, this isn't about Brian. This is about me not having a role in your life other than to be one of the pieces of furniture in the house. So this scene didn't offend me as much. I did like this little moment when Dr. David had given Michael the ticket. He goes off and gets into the car and Michael's in the doorway and he closes the door. But there's nothing left in the house at that point. Everything is on the van. It's like, where does Michael stay at that point? He's homeless, technically, because all of his belongings are in the van. All the furniture is loaded up or in storage. This is an empty house that he was left in. So a little small writing gap there. It was enough that in my second viewing, I saw that and reopened my notes. Normally, I don't do that. Normally, I write the notes the first time and don't touch them again. And this time, I had to go back and write that little moment down because I like the way that they were saying goodbye. But you can't say goodbye and then go back into the empty house, right?
I mean, he has friends. He knows where he can stay on a couch. Like, that's not, I don't think, necessarily a writing hole.
Well, the architecturally perfect mid-century modern house was always such a big thing for them, because you remember when Michael first moved in, he set all of his belongings out and he decorated it his style, and then David woke up and then Michael went to work and then they're all gone by the time he got back. It just seems strange that he's going to go into an empty house that had already been sublet. You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
A little bit, but that's fine. So it is the night of prom.
Oh, yes.
I love that everyone is at Debbie's house, like Eliza Doolittle. Justin gets the introduction from Emmett. And I will say, he looked fantastic in that tux. I was a big fan.
I don't know.
For 2000 prom, he looked fantastic in that tux.
Yeah, I thought he looked a little high schooled down. I mean, Gray is in high school, but it looked like they kind of pretty boyed him up a little bit more than usual.
Everyone wants to look their best for prom.
Well, he was less kind of slutty Babylon Justin and more straight-laced Justin. So
he
I thought that was interesting.
Well, I see nothing wrong with
definitely,
this.
Yeah, definitely cleaned up well. And Emmett cleaned him up. I can just imagine Emmett dressing him and being a valet, you know, kind of akin to
and
John Bates and Downton Abbey. And,
and everyone was super impressed with how he looked. Even Melanie, she was ready to jump on there.
That was so weird.
It's like, what? I was like,
she said that she would go for the handsome tuxedo clad Justin.
And I kind of wanted to remind everyone, again, he is in high school.
He's a teenager.
But it's fine. And
at the prom. This prom. I don't know where this prom is being held. This did not resemble the Here's My Heart dance where Jake and I.
Jakey.
Watch it.
Oh.
Justin and Daphne are sort of freaking on the dance floor. And in the background, we see Chris Hobbs.
Seething.
Yeah, he looked evil and sinister and creepy. And that first shot of him, I was like, uh-oh. And then Brian makes his big arrival. And my question here, though, for you, Matt, is how is that even possible? Can a 30-year-old just show up at a high school prom?
Where are the chaperones for this dance?
Are tickets required?
I had so many questions, again, about the logistics of this party. Where are the chaperones or the teachers? I would assume
Where's
that a
security?
Ticket...
security?
I'm sorry. If this older gentleman, I'm sorry, like, compared to some of these students.
He's
like,
not a boy.
He is. He's a man.
He's not a kid. He's a man. His name is Brian Kinney.
That's a throwback to previous episode.
That for him to just show up and the dance floor clears so he and Justin can have this, honestly, very romantic dance.
Spotlight dance.
Like, it was kind of fabulous. And I liked that they cut to showing the way some of the other students looked. Like, they looked uncomfortable seeing a man dancing with this teenager. But only Daphne was, like, laughing and enjoying it and saw that Justin was truly happy. And it was, overall, a very romantic moment, I thought.
Yeah, it was well shot. The music that we heard is Save the Last Dance for Me. That's not what you heard if you were watching the Netflix version. So my question is, for the love of God, Showtime, could you have not licensed one fucking song to make the cliffhanger of season one work? Did you have to pay somebody to write a cheap ripoff of that song that totally changes the scene? Honestly, somebody tell me why this was a good idea. I'm wound up again.
You will be receiving a letter from us, Netflix.
It's Showtime that did it, because Showtime is airing the same crap. Even still, it's like they were not at all selective about trying to relicense some of these songs for streaming. Could they not have been selective and said, these are important music cues in the series? This is where the music really matters. This is where the music makes the story. They didn't do that. They just took it out of their library, paid somebody to just sit in their house for a little while and rescore the entire series. It sucks. Thank you.
thus ends Patrick's rant for this episode.
I got one more.
Oh, am I? While they're having this beautiful romantic dance, complete with the dip and the kiss.
Oh, that was nice.
Michael is staring at this plane ticket.
He has nothing else to stare at. The house is empty.
That's true. So all he has is the plane ticket. We finally see Justin and Brian race outside the dance. I thought they were like just horny as all get out, and they were running away to fuck.
The dance ended with a kiss.
With the kiss.
And then they flew out of the ballroom.
And Michael is running through the airport now.
This was some nice cutting back and forth.
It was, but let's also talk about the airport security.
Or how Michael got to the airport that quickly. Yes. But I'm okay with the time shifting here, because the jumping back and forth between the two scenes worked for me. So I was okay with Michael all of a sudden teleporting to the airport.
And he... like he's like sort of going through security, and he asks about like if his flight has boarded, and they're like, it's just started boarding, you better hurry. And they just sort of push him through, and I'm like, oh no.
He did use the word stewardess, which clearly dated this. It didn't date it to like 2001, it dated it to like 1979.
But he's running towards the airport while Brian and Justin are saying their goodbyes in the parking lot. And
slow down a little bit here, because this is probably the most important scene that we've talked about. So to reset the stage, Michael has made the choice that he is going to get on that plane. He's going to Portland. Nothing else matters to him. He's just on his way. He committed to it. Brian made a kind of commitment to Justin by showing up at the prom, dancing with him, making out with him in front of the entire population, student body of St. James Academy. They finish the dance. Brian and Justin whisk off the dance floor. They're in a parking garage, and Justin says it's the best night of his life.
And this is a moment where I legitimately gasped the first time I saw this scene. Brian sees Chris in his rearview mirror and calls out to Justin, which causes Justin to turn around. But instead of it being a warning, it's too late for Justin to react, and instead he gets slammed in the head with the bat by Chris. So Brian runs out after Chris and shoves him and retaliates by knocking him in the knee and just runs to Justin.
At the same time, all this finishes up, we see that Michael has made it all the way to the gate. And when he gets the call from Brian, he turns around and starts running back the other way. Dr. David has no idea why Michael didn't show up. We see him on the plane. He's looking at the empty seat next to him. Doesn't have any idea what had happened. There's a quick cut to an overhead shot of the ambulance as Justin is being unloaded. This is a shot that's been used in tons of shows since then, like ER and The West Wing. But it was just so scary to see it here because there's just so much blood everywhere.
It's like incredibly graphic, and it's an incredible moment as well to indicate on the scarf how bloodied it was as well.
Brian steps out of the ambulance. He's carrying the scarf. It's just completely bloodied. The next shot that we see is Brian inside the hospital. He's sitting alone in the corridor. There's nobody else there. Michael arrives at the hospital to find Brian essentially having an emotional breakdown. This was Brian's what have I done moment for him. We see so many emotions coming out of Brian right there, and Gail Harold delivered the scene extraordinarily well without any lines. It was all just visual acting and physical acting. This was a huge turning point in the Brian character. Things are never the same. There's a hard cut to black, and the episode's over. Directors use hard cuts to really jar the viewer. That really jarred me here. My only complaint about this scene was the emotional oboe music with the choir that was playing. You probably liked it, though.
For 2000, I think it sold the horror. I think it was haunting in a way. But I think there's one moment that I really want to point out is that as they're down in this hallway, there is actually an edit that calls back to the first episode when they're running down the hallway of the hospital.
Oh, right, the night Gus was born. Yeah,
when Gus was born. It's such a stark contrast from what it meant being in the hospital for that to being in the hospital for this.
Hence the title, Full Circle.
And Gail Harold just really fucking delivered this scene. There's no dialogue. There are no words really needed to exchange for him. Everything he's feeling, the guilt, the blame, the love that he's feeling, every bit of emotion is coming through in this moment, and it's a hell of a way to end season one.
At the time, nobody knew what actually happened to Justin. Was he alive? Was he dead? What's next? This was one hell of a cliffhanger for gay show airing for the first time on national TV. This was really something of a cliffhanger. For all 22 episodes of season one, I've always been kind of the grumpy cynic about the show. Maybe because I've seen these episodes so many times over 17 years since they've aired. But I gotta tell you, this ending really gets me every time. It's just so emotionally devastating, and I love that kind of drama. At the time, people lived for this show. This was something, and I remember watching this episode at some bar in Chicago. It was probably Sidetrack, maybe, and people were literally crying at the ending. It was extraordinary. It made for a really strange transition from watching a drama like this in a bar to it being a gay bar. There was this weird silence while the credits were playing, and then all of a sudden club music started up. It was just so weird. It was a really hard transition.
So Patrick, 17 years later, how do you feel Full Circle holds up?
Mixed results. As drama, the A story of Brian turning 30 and the eventual Justin bashing scene was extraordinarily well acted and shot. The B story of Dr. David and Michael was watchable, but I just can't see something that extreme playing out that way in 2018. The runner story of Ted and Blake was predictable, but I can still see that happening today. So I'm mostly a yes, but with a little bit of no.
I'm going to be a soft yes on this one, especially for reasons I called out in the previous episode when it comes to the treatment of queer people by some folks in the heterosexual community. I think it's definitely still daring for people to go to, say, a prom or to a school dance as themselves rather than what is expected of them. I think that still carries an inherent amount of risk. Here I think it's not as scary as it was then, but there's still that little bit of danger. And I also think the way the relationships that play out, especially with Michael and Dr. David Cameron, again, trying to take that leap to the next step of your relationship. Like, I literally wrote at the end when Michael received that phone call, I just wrote, oh, damn. Mm-hmm. Oh, damn. Because he was clearly making what he felt was the right decision. And it just sucks that I don't think Dr. David Cameron could know in that moment. It's rough. So I'm going to be, again, a soft yes on this one.
I also liked when Michael got that call. We never actually saw Michael. He was around the corner of the gate. So we see a shadow and we see him drop his luggage. We don't see the actual moment. We see him come out of that moment. We see him go into the moment, come out of the moment, but it was well directed. So this was the final episode of season one, entitled Full Circle.
We will be back with episode one of season two, entitled Home is Where the Ass Is.
What a happy note. Thanks for watching season one with us. We enjoyed spending this time with you. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
Thanks for listening. Leave a like, share with a friend, and subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.
Hey, Todd, how's it going?
Fine.